Hello and welcome back to our digital class on soft condensed matter. Our last lesson unit has given us an introduction to that field. We have seen what soft matter actually is. It encompasses a whole range of materials, which are very diverse in appearance and properties, but which are actually based upon three very common fundamental properties. First, they are composed of building blocks with comparably large sizes, a lot larger than the size of atoms and molecules that serve as the building blocks in normal, hard condensed matter. Second, in addition to their large size, these building blocks interact by comparably weak interaction energies, a lot weaker than the strong energies of chemical bonds, for example, that we have in normal matter. In contrast to those, the interaction energies in soft matter are more of the order of magnitude of several multiples, up to some tens of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. A result of both the comparably weak interaction energies and the comparably large size of the building blocks is a low cohesive energy density of typically around only 10 to the 4 newtons per square meter. And that does directly translate into one of the most important material parameters of soft matter, which is the elastic modulus, explaining to us at this early stage of our lecture already why soft matter is soft matter. A third fundamental aspect of soft matter is that its building blocks exhibit comparably long relaxation times. These are the times it takes for the building blocks to move distances which are as wide as they are big. And as the building blocks of soft matter are comparably big, these distances are comparably long, and so it takes comparably long time for the building blocks to move those distances. But such motion is required for the material to show the onset of flow. And this means on common laboratory experimental timescales or on common everyday life application-relevant timescales, soft matter materials usually display the characteristics of both liquids and solids, being named viscoelastic materials. We have then also seen in our last lesson unit that there is many materials falling into this category. We have classified the landscape of soft matter in a triangular scheme often referred to as the Jülich soft matter triangle, delimiting soft matter to be everything which is polymeric, colloidal, and or amphiphilic in nature, or exhibiting all different sorts of hybrid forms in between these three extremes. And we have then also learned some fundamental aspects of these three stereotype representatives of soft matter: polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles. In this present lesson unit, we want to further dive into this and learn more about these fundamental soft matter material classes. And we will also learn about a very important methodology to characterize the structural characteristics of those systems: neutron scattering. Let us start our discussion by looking again on amphiphiles, which are also often named surfactants. Surfactants or amphiphiles are very special molecules. They consist of two parts: a hydrophilic head group and a hydrophobic tail group. This amphiphilic composition allows them to dissolve in both oil and water, whereby in both cases the respective phobic part assembles together to avoid contact to the medium, whereas the respective philic part establishes contact to the medium, which was shown to you in figure 2.7 of our script in our last lesson unit, now shown again here for recapitulation. The formation and structure of these micelles does actually depend on several important parameters. It depends on molecular parameters, basically the molecule geometry, and it also depends on concentration. At very low concentrations, there is actually not even yet a reason to form such micelles. Instead, the surfactant molecules then can simply form a monolayer at the surface of the respective fluid, with the respective philic group sticking into the fluid and the respective phobic group sticking out of it. As soon as the concentration passes a certain critical threshold, which is named the critical micelle concentration, in short CMC, micelles are formed, like shown in figure 2.7a. The specific form of the micelles then is dictated by the molecular geometry. We can capture this by introducing a so-called packing parameter, P, which is the molecular volume over the chain length and the head group area. The higher this packing parameter is, the lower is the interfacial curvature, and as a result, the more are ellipsoidal shapes preferred. In contrast, if we have a low packing parameter, then we have a high interfacial curvature, and so globular, spherical micelles are preferred. This means If we have surfactants with comparably bulky head groups, we have a tendency of more globular micelles to be formed, whereas if we have smaller head groups, more ellipsoidal structures are formed. If we further increase the packing parameter, which means decreasing the curvature, we obtain structures not even micelles anymore, but instead cylindrical or worm-like shapes, or bilayers, as shown in figure 2.7b. A very interesting variant of surfactant-based structures are microemulsions. These are emulsions built of a surfactant and two immiscible liquids, typically water and oil, whereby the minority component is encapsulated in the interior of respectively built micelles. Very important is to point out here that a microemulsion exhibits droplet sizes as given by the micelles. It's not the micelles that form around the fluid droplets, but the fluid droplets squeeze inside the micelles. And so we have very small droplets, and so the optical appearance of a microemulsion is not turbid or milky, but clear. If we have a mismatch of the amount of the two respective fluids and the amount of surfactant available to form micelles, we do not form larger micelles, as we would in a normal emulsion, but instead a respective supernatant phase of the fluid that cannot be accommodated in micelles. This is shown to you in figure 2.9 of our script. Micellar structures, either such consisting only of surfactant molecules or such consisting of surfactant molecules and a fluid component inside, like in microemulsions, usually do not assemble randomly in a system, but instead form higher ordered structures. For example, spherical micelles at suitable conditions can show tendencies of arranging on regular lattice kind of positions in the soft matter system, and so do cylindrical or worm-like assemblies. This may appear very counterintuitive at a first glance, because we may expect a random composition to be entropically more favorable. But it is actually entropy that in this case prefers a regular arrangement of the micelles, because when they are arranged regularly, they have the greatest possible average distances to each other and therefore can exhibit the greatest translational entropic freedom by moving around their lattice kind of position, so to speak. In contrast to real crystals, however, there is no strong interactions between these building blocks. And so the whole system is in a dynamic motion, is very flexible, and can display structural changes upon change of outer parameters, like concentration or temperature or other variables. This is one of the great strengths of soft matter. It shows a huge variety of very fascinating structures with respective properties. In the words of physical chemistry, we could say that soft matter has a very rich free energy landscape, with multiple local minima in the parameter-dependent free energy, each of which corresponding to different structures with different useful properties. Another very important and very versatile kind of soft matter is polymers. We have learned quite a lot about them already in our last lesson unit, and now we want to tie into this and learn even more. We have seen already that polymers are macromolecules built up of a repeating sequence of covalently jointed repeating units, commonly called monomer units, which are either made by chain growth or step growth polymerization processes. We have also seen that the shape of a polymer is most commonly a random coil, and suitable means to quantify the size of this is either the radius of gyration or the end-to-end distance. In this present lesson unit, we want to further understand where this actually comes from, and we want to see how it varies depending on the specific condition wherein which a polymer finds itself in. For that, we consider a so-called ideal polymer chain. This is a chain regarded at a very high level of simplification or abstraction, like we actually already did once in our elementary physical chemistry education when considering another very important ideal state of matter, the ideal gas. Like in that case, we now consider a polymer chain composed of monomer segments which we regard to have no interactions and no own volume. The result of this simplification is a polymer chain, the size and shape of which is determined by three factors: the length of each elementary structural unit, plus the bond that connects it to the next, the bonding angle between structural units, and the monomer bond torsion angle, as depicted to you in figure 2.10. The first two parameters, the length of a segment and the bonding angle, are fixed by the specific chemistry of the chain. Usually, the most common type of polymers are carbon-carbon based chain backbones, in which these two lengths are given by the carbon-carbon bonding, by the length of a carbon-carbon bond, which is usually 154 picometers, and the carbon-carbon bonding angle, which usually is the tetrahedron angle, 109 degrees. The latter parameter, however, the bond torsion angle, is usually comparably free. Of course, it requires some energy to rotate bonds against each other. It is more energy if we have bulky or repulsively interacting substituents at the two ends of the bond. But the absolute values of energy that we need to achieve such bond rotation are not overly high. It's usually around 10 to 20 times thermal energy at room temperature. This is something we can invest considerably well. Also, the energetic difference between states where substituents at the two ends of a bond are far apart in space, as compared to such states where they are close by in space, the first we name trans conformation, the latter we name cis or gauche conformation, is also not overly pronounced. Of course, it is energetically more favorable if bulky or repulsively interacting substituents are far apart in space, but the absolute value of how more favorable it is in energy to arrange a bond like that versus arranging it such that these substituents are closer by in space is usually just a few multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. That means whereas, of course, it is more favorable for the bonds to obtain a wide conformation, it's also energetically okay if this is not the case. And this means, from an energy standpoint, we would assume it to be a little more favorable if many bonds are in the wide trans arrangement. But we know that there is another quantity out there in the universe that dislikes this, and this is entropy. If we have a chain with many or all of its bonds being conformed in a trans state, this is actually a very high level of order along the chain. Whereas if we have a wild mixture of local cis and trans conformations, this is disorder. We can also discuss this from a statistical thermodynamics viewpoint. In very general, in statistical thermodynamics, we can appraise the entropy of a certain macrostate by the number of microstates that realize it. If we apply this to our case with a polymer coil, then the macroscopic conformation is the macrostate, and the sequences of arrangement of local cis or trans conformations along the chain contour are the microstates. And this means that, for example, a macrostate of a chain that is highly expanded, maybe even fully extended to a rod-like conformation, is realized by just a few number of microstates. The extreme case of a fully extended chain is realized by only one single microstate, namely the one where all the local bond torsion angles are in the trans conformation. Whereas the macrostate of a random coil is realized by many different microconformations, by many different sequences of mixtures of local cis and trans conformations. And this makes the random coil state more likely to occur, or in other words, it comes along with a higher entropy. This makes us understand why the natural conformation of a polymer is that of a random coil. There is one very important exemption: proteins. Proteins are composed of a very well-defined sequence of building blocks, which are amino acids, which leads to an energetic favoring of one specific conformation, which we name folding in the protein case. And there is a reason in nature for doing so. This one chosen folding or conformation comes along with a very specific chemical function. It provides a pocket where a certain key molecule can attach and being chemically converted. The key and lock principle of proteins in their action as biocatalysts. Common synthetic polymer molecules, by contrast, commonly display the shape of a random coil. When considering this in more detail, we can actually see that the segmental density in space is not homogeneous. It is higher in the core of the coil, where it is lower in its rim. And the radial segmental density profile, when going from the core to the rim, corresponds to a Gaussian profile, as shown in figure 2.11 and detailed in equation 2.7. This is why random coils are also often referred to as Gaussian coils or Gaussian chains. Up to this point, we have considered a very high level of simplification, ideal chains. What has happened if we drop this condition, if we allow the segments to have a certain own volume and to display interactions with each other and with a surrounding medium, a solvent? Again, this is a situation similar to one that we have encountered already in our physical chemical education when making the transition from the ideal to the real gas, where pretty much the same simplifications had to be dropped. The result in that case was that we have to discuss interaction potentials, like the Lennard Jones potential that we have discussed in our last lesson unit. We basically have attractive and repulsive interactions between molecules, which in our case are now monomer units along a polymer chain, whereby the repulsive forces constitute a very steep race of energy at short distances of separation of the molecules, which we can basically identify as the own volume of the molecules, while the attractive forces add to this a potential energy well at a certain most favorable distance, the equilibrium distance, Gleichgewichtsabstand. We can now adopt the very same principle to discussing the interaction of a monomer with other monomers and its surrounding. This means we basically have to discuss four kinds of interactions. Interactions between monomer and monomer, and interactions between monomer and solvent, which both have repulsive and attractive parts. To not get lost in this, we introduce so-called effective monomer-monomer interactions. These encompass the actual monomer-monomer interaction, and it also includes a mapping of the monomer-solvent interactions onto the monomer-monomer interactions. For example, if we have repulsive monomer-solvent interactions, this means a monomer segment in a polymer coil wants to avoid contact to solvent molecules. This is the same as if it would have attractive monomer-monomer interactions. And also vice versa, if we have attractive monomer-solvent interactions, this is the same as if we would have repulsive monomer-monomer interactions. This means we can simplify our discussion by only discussing effective monomer-monomer interactions, repulsive and attractive ones, which are either actual attractive or repulsive monomer-monomer interactions, or which are the respective counterpart in monomer-solvent interaction. This leads us to actually three kinds of scenarios. One is where a monomer-monomer contact is favored over monomer-solvent contact. This leads to attractive, effective monomer-monomer interactions. According to the principle, birds of a feather flock together, or in German, gleich und gleich gesellt sich gern. Second, we can have monomer-monomer interactions being equal to monomer-solvent interactions. This results in zero effective monomer-monomer interactions. This situation is encountered when monomer and solvent have practically the same structure. And so, for a monomer unit in a chain, it doesn't matter whether it interacts with another monomer unit on the chain or with a solvent molecule, because the solvent molecule just looks alike the other monomer. And the third case is if monomer-monomer contact is disfavored over monomer-solvent contact. This corresponds to repulsive effective monomer-monomer interactions. This is a rare special case scenario that we may encounter, for example, for polyelectrolytes, where each monomer unit carries a like charge that repel each other. A very helpful and also very fundamental parameter that comes into play here is the so-called excluded volume. As indicated by its name already, this is the part of the volume in a system that cannot be occupied by a monomer unit because it is already occupied by another monomer unit. And so it's basically the result of the interplay of repulsive and attractive interactions. The repulsive interactions act like the own volume of the monomer unit, whereas attractive interactions allow certain spatial proximity between a monomer unit and a second one. The excluded volume is maximal if repulsive interactions are maximal and if they are not compensated somehow by attractive interactions. Then we only have repulsive interactions being operative in the system, and this can be viewed like an impermeable own volume of the monomer, which cannot be occupied by another monomer. By contrast, if we also have some attractive interaction, this balances a part of the repulsive interactions and thereby makes the excluded volume smaller. We can even think about a situation where both contributions are equal, where repulsive and attractive interactions are in balance. Then we have no excluded volume. And, at least theoretically or hypothetically, we can also think about negative excluded volumes, where attraction outweighs repulsion. Based upon that consideration, we can basically imagine five different states of solvency of a polymer. Five different states wherein which polymers can find themselves in a surrounding solvent. The first situation is the so-called athermal solvent situation. This is one where monomer-monomer interactions are equal to monomer-solvent interactions. This means the effective monomer-monomer interactions are zero. For a monomer, it's equally fine to interact with its own kind along the chain or with surrounding solvent molecules, as they are just alike to its own kind. This means there is no effective monomer-monomer attraction, but instead only the repulsion that comes into play due to the own size of the monomers. This leads to a maximal excluded volume, which just corresponds to the monomer volume. We can basically simplify this as the length of a segment cube. Such a situation is realized if we dissolve a polymer inside a fluid, where the fluid molecules basically have the structure that also the repeating units along the chain have. For example, if we dissolve the polymer polystyrene in the solvent ethyl benzene. The reason why we name this solvency state the athermal solvent state is because it does not depend on temperature. If the monomer-monomer interactions are equal to the monomer-solvent interactions, so is their temperature dependence. If we change temperature, the interactions between monomer and monomer and monomer and solvent both change, but they change to same extent. And so this means the temperature change doesn't have any effect. The solvency situation is athermal. A seemingly good but not as perfect solvent situation is encountered if monomer-monomer interactions are slightly more favorable than monomer-solvent interactions. This means we have small effective attractive monomer-monomer interactions. Here still the repulsion due to the own size of the monomer units dominates, but it is compensated to at least some degree by the slight effective monomer-monomer attraction. As a result, we have an excluded volume which is still positive, but not as positive as it was in the athermal solvent case, and thereby lays between 0 and L cube. A typical example is polystyrene in the solvent toluene. If we further think along the preceding line, we come to a state where the monomer-monomer effective attraction is equally big to the monomer own volume. The effective monomer-monomer attraction exactly balances the repulsion due to the monomer own volume. We then are at a very interesting state, a so-called pseudo-ideal state, which we name theta state in polymer solutions. In this state, the excluded volume is zero. Its positive contributions, which come from the monomer own volume repulsion, are exactly balanced by the effective monomer-monomer attraction. This is a situation like we have in an ideal chain, which was a very simplifying model where we assumed the monomers to have no own volume. Again, in our physical chemical education, we have encountered a similar situation already. The real gas at the so-called boil temperature. This is a situation where also attractive and repulsive interactions between the gas molecules are just at balance. And so the real gas at this state behaves like an ideal gas, which we named a pseudo-ideal state. The name pseudo-ideal, or also quasi-ideal, denotes that the situation is not actually ideal. Actually ideal would it be if there would be no interactions. Here we have interactions, which are, however, at balance. This is what we name pseudo- or quasi-ideal. We can imagine already that for polymer systems, such a situation actually requires quite some mismatch in the structure of the polymeric repeating units and the surrounding solvent, because we need quite pronounced effective attractive monomer-monomer interactions, which correspond to quite pronounced repulsive monomer-solvent interactions. A typical example is polystyrene in the solvent cyclohexane. We can also imagine that this very special theta state is present at very special temperatures. For the example of polystyrene in cyclohexane, the so-called theta temperature is at 34.5 degrees Celsius. If we drop the temperature below that value, which in the laboratory can easily happen accidentally, we come to our next state, the state of a bad solvent. In this situation, the monomer-monomer interactions are much more favorable than monomer-solvent interactions, which means we have strong effective attractive monomer-monomer interactions, so strong that they outweigh the repulsive own volume of the monomer segments, leading to negative excluded volumes. In practice, this means that the polymer will then precipitate from the fluid medium. A typical example is polystyrene in ethanol. For theoretical purposes, we can further think this line to a situation where the monomer-monomer interactions are so much more favored over monomer-solvent interactions that the polymer is completely collapsing, expelling all solvent from it, leading to a maximally negative excluded volume, which is the counterpart to the athermal state excluded volume, in a sense that the excluded volume is the negative of the monomer volume, minus L cube. An example would be polystyrene in water. Depending on the solvency situation, a polymer coil compared to its ideal state will be more or less expanded. This can be quantified by introducing a so-called expansion factor, as done in equation 2.8. Figure 2.12 shows the effect of this. It shows us the segmental density profile of a polymer, in this case polystyrene, in two solvents. The theta solvent, cyclohexane, at 34.5 degrees Celsius, as represented by the blue curve, and a good solvent, toluene at room temperature, as represented by the green curve. And we see that the polymer in the latter case is more expanded. We have a greater occupation of areas far away from the core, at large distances. To express this in a handy formula, we again consider the mean square end-to-end distance, like it's done in equation 2.9. Here it is the root of that, the root mean square end-to-end distance, which is proportional to the number of segments and powered by an exponent, which is named the Flory exponent, times the length of a segment. In our last lesson unit, we have seen that for ideal polymer coils, the mean square end-to-end distance was proportional to n times L square. Here we take the root of it, so this means the root mean square end-to-end distance for ideal chains should be proportional to n with the power of 1/2 times L. And this is indeed the value of this Flory exponent nu that we have for ideal coils. For real coils in a good solvent, this exponent has a higher value. It has a value of 3 over 5, which means that the coil will be more expanded. We will obtain a bigger value for the root mean square end-to-end distance for a given n and L. Whereas by contrast, for polymers in bad solvents, this exponent is only 1/3, corresponding to a collapsed globule. The third elementary material stereotype of soft matter are colloids. We have discussed this very briefly in our last lesson unit, and now want to tie into that and discuss this in some more detail. For the sake of simplicity, we only consider a very simple kind of colloid, hard spheres. Like normal molecules, or like the monomer units in our polymers before, they display interactions of repulsive and attractive kinds, again leading to the concept of excluded volume. The interactions are typically constituted by electrostatic interactions if the particles are charged, and steric repulsion, which usually comes into play if we graft polymer chains on the surface of colloidal nanoparticles to stabilize them in solution. Opposing to that, we can have attraction between the colloids by typically van der Waals forces. Depending on the particle concentration and kinds of interactions, the particles are in the end either dispersed or aggregated in a solution or suspension. For the very simple case of hard spheres, we can construct a phase diagram as shown to you in figure 2.13. It displays different phases depending on the particle concentration, which is here expressed as the particle volume fraction. As long as the volume fraction is small, below 0.494, the particles can completely distribute in the surrounding medium in a random fashion, constituting a fluid phase. If the volume fraction is higher than that, at least a portion of the material must form an ordered crystalline phase, which increases in its amount or magnitude if the volume fraction increases. From a concentration of 0.545 on, the complete system is filled by crystal. And the phase diagram ends at a volume fraction of 0.741, then we have the closest packing that is possible for solid spheres, and we cannot accommodate more spheres into the system. Underneath the volume fraction axis, we see another state, the glassy state. This is a state where we have random arrangement of the particles, but jamming, such that they block each other in mobility. This state is achieved if we quickly quench such a solution, if we quickly increase the volume fraction to a value of at least 0.58, spanning up to volumes of 0.64, from which on random packing is no longer possible and the spheres then must again be regularly packed to form a crystal. A higher level of complexity comes into play if we consider colloids that are electrostatically stabilized, which usually colloids are. In this case, we can quantitatively appraise their interactions and therefore also their phase state by the very famous DLVO theory, named after the initials of four scientists that have developed it. In this theory, the stability of a particle depends on the total energy in the system, which is composed of attractive van der Waals forces and repulsive electrostatic interactions. To be precise, the electrostatic interactions are here modeled such that we imagine the particle to have charges on its surface plus a layer of counterions directly close to it. And if now two such particles come into close proximity, their superficial electric ion layers interpenetrate, which comes along with a repulsive energy penalty. In the DLVO theory, we assume that the attractive and repulsive forces, or respectively their potentials, are simply additive, with different signs, as we have also discussed it in our last lesson unit in the context of the Lennard-Jones potential. And just like in this case, depending on which one is dominant, We have a dispersed or a coagulated system. If attractive forces dominate, the latter happens. We observe coagulation. This is the case for both small and large distances between spherical colloids. By contrast, at intermediate distances, the repulsive forces dominate, and a stable colloidal system is obtained. Figure 2.14 shows you several cases of resulting interaction energy potentials. Panel A shows the two contributing parts, like in the Lennard-Jones potential, a repulsive part with positive values of the energy and an attractive part with negative values of the energy. Panels B, C, D, and E then show different kinds of overlay of these two potentials with different magnitudes and contribution of one or the other. In the case B, the resulting potential is negative at all distances, which means that here the attractive forces dominate and the system will always coagulate. And will do so very fast, by the way. By contrast, the curve in figure C displays two minima, a local and a global one, separated by an energy barrier. The local minimum at intermediate distances leads to reversible particle attraction, often referred to as flocculation. This can lead to loose phase separation that is reversible. Next to that, at short distances, is a very pronounced global minimum. And depending on the height of the energy barrier in between, also this one can be reached, which leads to irreversible coagulation. Panel D shows a variant form of this, where the longer distance minimum is minimally present. And a very special case is shown in panel E. This is a situation encountered at the so-called critical coagulation concentration, where the energy maximum has a value of zero. We can see from all these different curves that either complete coagulation can occur or local stability of a loosely aggregated state versus random dispersion of the colloids. The decisive factor whether or not we fall into complete coagulation is the height of the energy barrier that separates the low distance absolute minimum. We always have thermal energy in our system, and this means the particles can actually overcome barriers of around 10 to 15 times the thermal energy at room temperature, which then may lead to coagulation. This means to stabilize a colloidal system, we need energy barriers between it larger than that. This does also translate into how fast coagulation processes happen. You may know this from elementary physical chemistry already. The higher an energy barrier between two states, for example, in a reaction coordinate diagram between eddies and products, the less often is it overcome, and the slower is the kinetics of a process, like a chemical reaction, for example. Here, this means if we have no or low barriers present, fast coagulation will happen, where every particle collision leads to aggregation, whereas in the case of pronounced barriers, slow coagulation will happen, where particles need to come together with sufficient energy to overcome the barrier and then aggregate. In general, a stable colloidal system, which is stabilized by electrostatic interactions, is obtained for particles with high surface potentials, low electrolyte concentration in the surrounding, polar media like water, and low temperatures. Okay, after having detailed again on these three stereotype representatives of soft matter, let us now close this lesson unit by briefly considering a very important experimental technique to characterize the various structures that these and other soft matter systems can display. This technique is neutron scattering. In very general, in scattering techniques, we shine radiation or quantum objects onto matter and observe to what extent they are scattered in space. This depends on the structural arrangement of the system and on by what means contrast is generated between the material and the incident radiation or quantum object, which means that from the scattering intensity pattern, we can backdraw conclusions on the structural arrangement of the system. Basically, such experiments are conducted with three different kinds of radiation or quantum object to be scattered: light, X-rays, and neutrons. We can guess already that the extent of scattering will have to do with interference of the radiation, and this then has to do with its wavelength. In very general, scattering techniques are able to probe distances or sizes or length scales in our material corresponding to the wavelength of the incident radiation. This means that light scattering is very suitable to probe structures in the range of a couple hundreds of nanometers up to micrometers, whereas scattering of other radiation, such as X-rays or neutrons, is suitable to probe smaller structures. This does make X-ray scattering a very powerful technique in hard matter science, where we probe crystal lattice structures, for example. This is typically done with X-ray scattering. The application of X-ray scattering, however, is a little precluded for soft matter systems because these beams are very energetic, they are very energy rich. And this means for soft matter, which is composed of things held together by comparably weak interaction energies, we have a quite pronounced danger of destroying our material. This is the reason why neutron scattering is very attractive for soft matter. It works as just said. Nutrients hit a sample and are scattered by parts of the sample, specifically by the nuclei of the atoms that constitute the material. This is shown to you in figure 2.15 of our script. Neutrons can also be scattered by unpaired electron spins in the shell of a molecule if they possess a magnetic moment. This is a special variant of neutron scattering, giving very valuable information about magnetic systems, but that we want to disregard here. According to the de Broglie condition, we can attribute wave properties to neutrons. And so, neutron waves can impact the medium, be scattered on scattering centers, which are the nuclei of the atoms in the system, and then be re-irradiated into space as spherical waves that can interfere, showing both destructive and constructive interference in different directions from which we can draw conclusions back to the spatial arrangements of the scattering centers in the sample. Basically, this scattering can happen with either retainment of the frequency or change of the frequency of the incoming and the scattered radiation. If the frequency of the incoming and the scattered radiation is the same, we speak about coherent scattering, whereas we speak about incoherent scattering if the frequency of incident and scattered beam is different. Furthermore, the scattering can or cannot come along with an energy exchange between the incident neutrons and the scattering centers. If there is no such energy exchange, we speak about elastic scattering. Is energy exchange, we speak about inelastic scattering. If the energy exchange is there but small, then we name this quasi-elastic. As a result, there are 6 different types of scattering: coherent elastic scattering, incoherent elastic scattering, coherent inelastic scattering, incoherent inelastic scattering, coherent quasi-elastic scattering, and incoherent quasi-elastic scattering. Out of these 6 different types of scattering, 5 are used for neutron scattering in soft matter science. Coherent elastic scattering is used to investigate nanometer scale structures in soft matter systems, for example, the conformation of polymers, whereas coherent inelastic scattering gives us insights into dispersion curves of such systems. With incoherent inelastic scattering, instead, we can probe, for example, vibrations of side groups of polymers, whereas furthermore, the quasi-elastic methods are used to study dynamics of such systems, for example, the motion of polymers in solutions. We are predominantly interested here in coherent elastic scattering, because this gives us structural information. We can describe this by a simple vector picture. Let K0 be the so-called wave vector of the incident wave, and K the wave vector of the corresponding scattered wave. We can then introduce a so-called scattering vector simply as the difference between scattered and incident radiation, as shown in figure 2.16. For the case of elastic scattering, this scattering vector has a magnitude as given in equation 2.10. We see that it depends on the wavelength of the scattered radiation and the angle of observation. This means by these 2 parameters, we can vary the scattering vector. And this is what we do in a scattering experiment. We vary this vector and measure the scattering intensity as a function of this vector. And this will vary due to interference of the scattered radiation. This is shown to you in figure 2.17. We see 2 scattering centers, both being hit by an incident wave front, and then as a result, both emitting spherical waves into space, which in certain directions display constructive interference and in others displaying destructive interference. And we now record this scattering pattern as a function of the scattering wave vector by varying the scattering angle and, if we wish, also varying the wavelength if possible. And this gives us a so-called scattering curve. The principle of how we now obtain structural information from this is to also calculate the scattering curve. We can go ahead and assume a certain structural arrangement of our scattering centers in the system, and then follow the simple principles shown in figure 2.17 and calculate how we would expect the scattering curve to look like for this arrangement. And if we then compare the calculated scattering curve to the recorded scattering curve and they match, this means that our assumed structure is supported by the experimental data. It's not proven, but supported. Of course, in that endeavor, our life gets complicated because usually samples consist of more than only 2 atoms, as shown in figure 2.17. To take this into account, first, the sum over all the amplitudes of pairs of atoms has to be extended to all pairs of atoms to get a complete interference. And second, then, individual atoms must be regrouped and described by a density, which means treated with a continuum approach. This is justified as the size of the atoms is usually smaller than the structures we probe in a neutron scattering experiment. With this technology, we then have several great advantages at hand to study soft matter systems. First, neutrons have a high penetration power, meaning they are able to enter samples quite substantially, in contrast to other techniques, such as transmission electron microscopy, for example, which is only suitable or applicable to very thin films. Second, the wavelength of neutrons is just in the range that is interesting for soft matter systems, allowing us to probe structures in the range of a portion of a nanometer up to several tens of nanometers. Third, and most importantly maybe, the energy of a neutron is comparably weak. It's in the range of thermal energy, which is characteristic for soft matter systems and ensures that we do not break or destroy them during a neutron scattering experiment. And fourth, and even more favorably, the amount or extent of neutron scattering is heavily different depending on whether the scattering occurs with a hydrogen or with a deuterium atom core. These are the typical elements that contribute to the scattering of neutrons, and they are present in any organic matter, as it's the basis in many soft matter systems. This means local replacement of hydrogen by deuterium in, for example, polymer systems allows us to do specific contrasting in scattering experiments. For example, if we think about block hole polymer systems that assemble in certain structures, for example, micelles or sheets or so, we can think about doing selective deuteration of one of the blocks while not deuterating the other. This will selectively contrast the one in comparison to the other, allowing us to observe specifically where it sits in the system. We could do the same for surfactant micelles, for example, to selectively contrast either the head groups or the tail groups. It is this combination of advantages that makes neutron scattering a very versatile technique in soft matter science, with the drawback that it's instrumentally demanding. What we need for that, of course, is a neutron source. This is something we do not have in our laboratory. For that, we have to go to large-scale research facilities where we typically apply for beam time. This means we need to write a proposal where we describe a certain set of experiments that we would want to do and justify why it's important to do them. And then we get an allocation of typically something between 3 and 5 days of beam time. And in that time, we have to conduct these experiments. Typically, one neutron scattering experiment takes half a day, 6 hours. So we can actually accommodate not much more than 4 to 6 experiments in the allocated beam time, as we also must do empty cell measurements and plain fluid measurements to subtract those data from our scattering data of the actual samples later. This means neutron scattering has to be well thought out. But if it's done so, it commonly guarantees a scientific publication. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has given us a more detailed second view on the most fundamental kinds of soft matter systems, showing us how they form structures, and also showing to us already how these structures are delicately dependent on environmental parameters. This is another very important fundamental hallmark of soft matter. Its sensitivity, its ability to change between structures corresponding to local minima in the free energy landscape quite easily by variation of environmental parameters, giving a huge richness in structures and corresponding properties, which can be interconverted into each other, thereby forming the basis for adaptive, even up to lifelike systems. This is what I hope makes consideration of soft matter science and the underlying physics really vivid.